Questions of Faith, Lecture 7. The Case Against Life After Death.
Probably the two most important claims of theistic religion are the existence of God and life after death. Dostoevsky always puts them together, God and immortality. We'll begin our investigation of this question of life after death in the same way as we began with the existence of God, with the simplest solution, that it just doesn't exist at all. There are seven basic answers to what happens to us after death, and the simplest one is nothing, because there is no immortal spirit or soul. This is philosophical materialism. Materialism in this context doesn't mean the attitude of greed for material things, for money and the things money can buy, but the philosophical theory that says that human beings are simply material organisms and nothing more. There is no spiritual soul. If there is no spiritual soul in just the material body, then there's pretty obviously no survival of death, because we can see what happens to the body. Just dig up a corpse. This is the simplest answer to the question, just as atheism is the simplest answer to the question of God. We will examine five arguments for materialism and the ways philosophers who do believe in a life after death have tried to answer those arguments, and we'll conclude with a brief examination of reincarnation as another theory of life after death. But first, let's summarize the seven basic answers to the question of what happens when we die. The first is materialism. You decay and get eaten by worms, period, end of story. This belief has always been a possibility, but it's always been a minority view. However, since the 18th century, a significant number of educated people in industrialized countries have believed it. It naturally fits together with atheism, although it doesn't have to. But if you don't believe in anything like God, in any kind of God, you probably don't believe in immortality. And if you do believe in God, you probably do believe in immortality. In ancient Greece and Rome, immortality was the one distinguishing feature of every kind of God, and they had quite a few different kinds of gods. And it was often believed that if a mortal became a great hero, he would attain immortality and become a god. As for the rest of us, we became ghosts after death. And that is a second view of life after death, typical of ancient paganism. Some vague, shadowy self survives and goes to the underworld, the place of the dead, where it is less alive, less substantial, less real than the flesh and blood body we now have. What survives is only a pale copy or image of the original, like a ghost image on a photograph or a TV screen. This is in sharp contrast to the religious view, where you become more alive, more real after death. There's a third view, found in some other ancient societies, that's a bit more optimistic. It says that everyone, and not just heroes, gets more life and not less after death, gets to go to the land of the spirits or the gods, and usually there is one great spirit above all the spirits. A fourth view, reincarnation, is more common in the Orient than in the West, but it is becoming more popular today among people who have lost faith in the Orthodox Jewish, Christian, and Islamic heaven or paradise. Reincarnation means that your individual soul never dies, and after your body dies, your soul comes back in another body. The notion of reincarnation is usually connected with another idea, karma, that each soul has to fulfill its just destiny and learn its lessons of wisdom and morality, and that's why it keeps reincarnating until it is good and enlightened enough. So this world is a kind of reform school with remedial classes. Reincarnation and karma are two of the teachings of most forms of Hinduism and Buddhism, and there it's connected with a fifth idea of what happens at death, which Western philosophers call monism or pantheism, the idea that ultimately there is only one thing, that everything is a part or form or manifestation of that one thing, and that one thing is something like God. Hindus call it Brahman, the Great One. Buddhists do not call it anything. In this philosophy, reincarnation does not mean that individual souls are real and survive. Individuality is an appearance or a projection of unenlightened consciousness. Most modern Westerners who adopt reincarnation don't realize that in Eastern religions it does not mean individual immortality at all. The Hindu Upanishads say Brahman is the only real reincarnator. So this fourth view is not ultimately reincarnation, but pantheism or monism. There is a sixth view that each individual soul is immortal, but there is no resurrection of the body. After death, we become something like angels. This is the view of Plato and of the ancient Gnostics. And the seventh view, found in Orthodox Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is that each person created by God in his image is immortal, and that God will raise up or resurrect our bodies after death to go with our immortal souls, so that we can live forever with body and soul in heaven or paradise in a perfected relationship with God, the ultimate good, but only if we choose it. We could also choose the opposite, a disrelationship with God, who is the source of all good, and that would be necessarily the ultimate evil. The main issue about life after death that philosophers of religion argue about is whether the soul survives the death of the body or not. Materialism says no. All the religious views say yes. So we should first look at arguments for materialism, the case against the existence of any kind of life after death. The first argument is the simplest and the most serious. The first premise is, if there is to be personal survival after death, then the personal self, the I, must survive. The second premise says, if there is a personal self, an I, then that must be conscious. The third premise is that this consciousness depends on the brain. We observe that a blow to the head impairs consciousness, and a fatal blow stops it altogether. In other words, we observe a causal dependence of consciousness on the brain. Fourth premise, when the brain dies, the body dies. Conclusion, therefore, the self dies when the brain and body die. Which of these four premises could be denied by the believer in individual immortality? Probably only the third one, that consciousness depends on the brain. But we do observe a causal connection between physical brain activity and mental activity. But that connection could be interpreted the other way, as causal activity from the mind to the body, rather than from the body to the mind. And I think that is not as occult or mystical as it may seem to be. It's a fact of daily experience. The cause of my tongue moving right now is my mind commanding it to do so. I experience my body as the instrument of my mind and will. It's a much more complex instrument than a pen or even a computer, and I'm related to that instrument in a much more intimate way than my hand is related to a pen, but there is some similarity between the two relations. When my hand drops my pen, the pen stops writing, but my hand doesn't stop living. So it may be that the soul and body are related like that. The body is the soul's pen, so to speak, its instrument of self-expression. If that's so, then when the body dies, the soul would lose its instrument of self-expression, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that the soul would have to die. In fact, there even seems to be empirical evidence for self-consciousness without brain activity on the part of patients who suffer brain death for a significant length of time, often up to 20 minutes or more, and who then come back, so to speak, and relate all sorts of things that they were thinking and knowing while their brain was clinically dead. And some of these things can be checked out empirically. For instance, they say they hovered over their body and outside their body, and they saw three doctors in the operating room shaking their heads, or they saw somebody stealing drugs from the drug closet or dropping a wedding ring in the bathroom sink. And then afterwards, when they come back into their bodies and their brains start to work again and they recover, they relate these things and the hospital staff checks them out and finds out that they were true. This is not just National Enquirer stuff. This is scientific data, and there are responsible places that keep careful records of cases like these. One of them is at the University of Connecticut. The philosophical point is simply that it is logically possible. So the materialist's argument is not conclusive. That does not mean we've proved the existence of a spiritual soul, much less its immortality. That requires further arguments, positive ones, if there are any. A second argument for materialism and against immortality is that even if self-consciousness is possible without a brain, consciousness of the world is not possible without a brain and a body and senses. So death, in robbing us of the brain and the body, robs us of the only means by which we can experience the world. So if we can't experience any world outside of us after death, how can you say we survive death? How can there be a self without some consciousness of an other? The premise of this argument is probably true, that without a brain we have no access to any material objects. But this access to a world of objects does two things. It gives us knowledge of the world, but it also changes us. It gives us information, it makes our mind grow, it makes our character grow, it makes our memory grow. In other words, our acts of a soul in relating to the world before death always have a kind of rebound effect on ourselves, like exercising in a gym. We develop intellectual and moral muscles, virtues, character. Now, even if death robs us of the opportunity to do any of that anymore at all, that doesn't mean that it robs us of the very self that did it when it had a body. If you add the belief that God gave us these bodies in the first place and therefore could resurrect them or give us new ones after death, then you could have a complete human person after death with body and soul. In order to see what the hypothesis means, let's look at an analogy. Imagine a sudden silence stopping a symphony orchestra from making any noise. The instruments all break. Still, the form or formula or essence of the music would still exist on paper. And therefore, the instruments, if they could be repaired, could play that same music in the future. Or imagine a movie. It suddenly stops unrolling onto the screen. But it still exists in the reel, in the projection booth. If so, it could play again on the same screen, or on a better one. Now, these are only analogies, and very inadequate ones, and analogies can't prove anything, but they can open the mind to possibilities. And if you throw God into the picture, it becomes possible. If there's a God who created us in the first place, he could certainly repair us. If he can do the bigger miracle, he could do the smaller one. So the hypothesis, again, has not been conclusively refuted. A third materialist argument against the hypothesis of life after death is this. If the individual soul lives on after the death of the body, it must have an individual identity. But if it has an identity, it must be identifiable. But how could we identify or distinguish one soul from another after all three bodies are dead? In this life, we always use bodily criteria. Different people look different, and even two identical twins have to be in different places with different chunks of matter. So if individuality depends on bodies and bodies die, individuality must die. This is a serious question. I can think of four possible answers to it. First, even if we don't know how a soul could identify other souls, it doesn't follow that it couldn't do it. Second, even if it couldn't identify other individual souls, it doesn't logically follow that those other souls don't exist. But third, let's state the problem concretely rather than abstractly. How could Romeo distinguish Juliet from his mother after all three are dead? I suppose by a kind of mental telepathy. Romeo knows and loves Juliet. What does that mean? Not just her body, but herself, her soul, her personality. Now, Romeo discovered that personality through bodily means, but he keeps it in his mind. And that's what he could still love even after Juliet got old and gray on Earth. Suppose Juliet had an identical twin. Call her Jill. Romeo wouldn't confuse Juliet with Jill, though a stranger might. So why would Romeo suddenly lose that ability after death? Even in this life, we use criteria other than bodily ones to identify persons sometimes. Think of the Star Trek episode in which Captain Kirk and another starship captain each have their soul put into the other's body. It's not the matter in the body, but the personality that comes out in moving the matter, in other words, the soul, that tells you that this person is Captain Kirk, even though he's in the other captain's body. We all use non-bodily criteria, sometimes, to identify ourselves. We are not our height or weight or hair color or shape. All these things change, and yet we remain the same person. If we didn't remain the same unchanged person, there could be no self to recognize the change, to say, I have changed. And if we know ourselves by self-consciousness, perhaps we can know others by a kind of mental telepathy with other self-conscious minds. Mental telepathy sometimes seems to happen in this life, so presumably it could happen to souls after death. A fourth answer might be that even if there is no mental telepathy, and we couldn't know each other between death and a future bodily resurrection because we have no bodies, we could still know each other again after bodily resurrection, which is part of the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic picture. A further argument for materialism and against an immortal soul is from neurobiology. There is not a single so-called spiritual event that cannot be accounted for by some material cause or event in the brain. If you alter the brain, you alter the consciousness. We can be made to see different colors or no colors. We can be made angry or peaceful. We can be made to calculate faster or slower or not at all simply by physically altering our brain with electrical charges or drugs or incisions. So the believer in a spiritual soul cannot produce a single so-called spiritual event that cannot be explained and even produced by a corresponding material event in the brain. Well, let's suppose that premise is true. What does it prove? Even if we don't find any independent spiritual event, even if we refute all the evidence for out-of-body experiences, still, what does that prove? Imagine two columns. Label the first physical or material, and the second spiritual or immaterial. Now list dozens of events in each column. The materialist argues that he can explain every event in the spiritual column by pointing out a corresponding event in the material column. And therefore, the whole spiritual column is merely a copy, an image, an extra. It's dispensable by Occam's razor. If we can explain everything materially, then spiritual explanations are superfluous. The argument seems quite sound, but exactly the same premise could be used by a spiritualist who believes that the whole physical column is a mere illusion or image. Spiritualism is just as simple a hypothesis as materialism. It says matter is a useless extra. It argues that you can't point to a single material event that is independent of a spiritual event. For as soon as you point to it, as soon as you're conscious of it, that means it's an event in consciousness. So why add this second column at all? Why not say there is only one column, the spiritual, the mental, and say that matter is a projection of consciousness? That's what many Hindus and Buddhists would argue. There's a third philosophy that also explains all the data, besides materialism and spiritualism. It's common sense dualism. The belief that both columns are real and intimately related. They're either two different realities that interact or two dimensions of the same reality, like the borderline between Canada and America. From the viewpoint of America, it's a bump in Canada. From the viewpoint of Canada, it's a dip in America. This seems to account for our ordinary experience as well as the other two. We experience matter-altering mind and mind-altering matter. When someone hits you, you get angry. When they kiss you, you get happy. That's matter over mind. But when you direct your attention to a problem, your brain obeys like a computer. And when you decide to move your hand to write, your hand obeys. That's mind over matter. Neurobiology doesn't talk about the soul or the spirit, and it shouldn't. But that doesn't mean spirit is unreal. It means that neurobiology is an empirical science. It has to abstract from any dimensions that its instruments can't reveal. Similarly, mathematics is a science that has to abstract from quality in order to deal with quantity. But that doesn't mean quality is unreal. So the arguments for materialism, though strong, seem inconclusive. Are there also arguments against materialism? Yes, and they will probably also seem both strong and inconclusive. First, there's the evidence we mentioned earlier from out-of-the-body experiences. Second, there's arguments that thought transcends matter in many ways. For instance, thought can be in many places at one time. For instance, when you hold in your mind New York and San Francisco and compare them. You can't hold them together in space because they're material bodies, and two bodies can't occupy the same space at the same time. But you can hold them together in your mind, simultaneously. That's what it means to compare them. Thought also transcends matter by the same thought being in many minds at once. That's what it means to communicate. When we teach, the same thought comes to be in the mind of a student without leaving the mind of the teacher. Nothing material can do that. No single piece of matter or pieces of matter can be in different places at the same time. And thought can. Therefore, thought, it seems, is not matter. But thought is real. Therefore, not everything that is real is matter. But that is materialism, that everything that is real is matter. Another way thought can transcend physical law is by abstraction. We can know abstract, timeless, universal truths like 2 plus 2 equals 4, or concepts like equality or truth, which have no spatial or temporal dimensions to them at all. Still another way thought transcends physical law is that when we are aware of anything, such as another person, we can be aware of many things at once, many colors, shapes, sounds, feelings, but this does not result in a heap of awarenesses. There is one awareness of many things. The self that is aware of many things is a single self, like a dimensionless point at the center of a circle. Here is another argument. The materialist claims that his philosophy is true, and he claims to prove his conclusion with logical arguments, and expects us to understand and agree with those arguments and their conclusions. But if materialism is true, truth is material, or else it's unreal. For according to materialism, all that is real is material. But it makes no sense to say truth is a material reality. It has no material qualities. Truth is what is common to ideas like 2 plus 2 equals 4, the sky is blue, I exist, and the Empire State Building is in New York City. But there's nothing material that is common to those four things, not a single atom. Here's a different way to put the same argument from truth. Let's assume that materialism is true, that the material universe is everything that exists. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that there are a certain quantity of energy or a certain number of elementary particles in this universe, say 10 to the 400th power. Let's symbolize that quantity by X. So, the ideas that the universe is composed of X minus 1, or X plus 1 quantity of matter or energy, these are false ideas. And the idea that the universe is composed of exactly X quanta is a true idea. But if ideas are material, then this idea of X is simply one of the parts of X. But that's like having one of the people in a large room count how many people there are in the room. There's a dilemma here. If he doesn't count himself, he's wrong. And if he does, he's also wrong because ideas aren't supposed to count themselves, so to speak. Ideas aren't about themselves. Ideas are about other things. They're objects. An idea is supposed to forget itself, so to speak. The sign is not one of the things signified by the sign. To be a sign is to point beyond yourself, and ideas are signs. Here's still another way to put the same argument from truth. Ideas are either true or false. They're like prisoners on trial. We need to know whether they're innocent or guilty. But the judge can't be one of the prisoners. The judge of the prisoners has to transcend the prisoners. But according to materialism, there is no transcendent judge called mind or soul or spirit to judge the ideas which are the prisoners, which are all just movements of matter or material energy in the brain. So materialism seems to contradict itself. It's the idea that there aren't really any such things as ideas. To put it very crudely, the problem in materialism is not the material, but the ism. Here is another argument, the argument from the nature of arguments. The materialist claims to prove materialism with logical arguments and expects us to understand these arguments and follow their logic and be convinced by them. But what is argument in a materialist world? If there's room only for the relation of material cause and effect, there's no room for the relation of immaterial premise and conclusion. It would seem that the materialist is confusing the two basic meanings of the word because. Cause and reason. When I say he got wet because he stood out in the rain, I mean the cause of his getting wet was his standing out in the rain. That's physical causality. But when I say he must have been standing out in the rain because he is wet, I mean the reason I know he was standing in the rain is that I know he is wet. I am not causing his wetness or his standing. I am reasoning from the effect back to the cause. I can also reason from the cause to the effect. I can predict that if he stands in the rain, he will get wet. Reasoning is not causing. It's not a physical thing at all. So it would seem that the materialist is contradicting himself in appealing to reasoning to prove materialism. If reasoning is merely causing, then there's no premise-conclusion relation. Even if there are these problems with materialism, and even if materialism is refuted, however, that does not prove immortality. Just because there is a soul does not prove that it is an immortal soul. We need more arguments. Even if there is weakness in materialism, there are also weaknesses in the notion of immortality. And we'll look at some of those next time. But before we do, let's briefly explore an alternative conception of life after death, reincarnation. Hindus and Buddhists accept reincarnation on grounds of religious authority, and Christians, Jews, and Muslims reject it for the same reason. But there are also arguments both for and against reincarnation that do not depend on faith or religious authority, but only on reason. I think there are three main arguments for reincarnation. The first argument is actual data. People often remember past lives, or claim to. Most of the time, this is probably imaginary and often silly. People almost always claim to have been someone famous or interesting. If all the claims are true, then almost everyone must have been a king or a queen and no one was ever a slave. But sometimes the claims seem credible, when people claim to remember past lives in detail, and sometimes the details check out, such as the location of hidden treasures. These cases are rare, but they do exist. Can they be explained without reincarnation? Probably. As something like a racial memory, or a collective unconscious, or even mental telepathy with the dead, with ghosts who transfer their knowledge of these details into the minds of the living. By the way, there is a surprisingly large, diverse, and scientifically credible heap of evidence for the existence of ghosts. And there are sober scientific organizations that study such phenomena, such as the British Society for Psychical Research. A second piece of evidence for reincarnation is not one that can be checked empirically, but it's very common and apparently very wise. It's a premise about self-knowledge. Only unwise people, only shallow and arrogant people who don't know themselves, can believe that they're perfect. Most of us know that even if our lives have been quite full and satisfying, we're not perfect. We're not as good or as wise as we could be. Even the best of us, especially the best of us, say we're fools. Only fools say they're wise, and only great sinners say they're saints. The wise know that they're fools, and the saints know that they're sinners. Now, when we die, we're not yet done. We're not yet fully cooked, so to speak. We're not all that we can be. There is a great gap between the actual and the potential, between the real and the ideal. Only if we vastly overestimate our actuality or vastly underestimate our potentiality can we deny that great gap. Now, even those who don't believe in reincarnation usually agree with both sides of this premise, the gap between what we are and what we ought to be. One side could be called hope and the other humility. The wiser and the better we are, the more of both hope and humility we have. That is, the more we believe that we're called to be something utterly glorious and saintly and wise, something of which we catch only brief glimpses in this life, and therefore we feel humble, judged by that high ideal. Well, that is a profound premise, but it doesn't prove reincarnation. Reincarnation does explain and justify this deep insight, yes. But I see no way of proving that reincarnation is the only way of justifying it. In fact, it might be argued that reincarnation is a rather unimaginative way. It realizes we have a long way to go, but it says the road ahead is only more of the same, more segments of the road behind. According to reincarnation, the gap between what we are and what we are called to be is closed by an addition of quantity, not quality, by more lives of the same kind, in the same world, in the same sort of body. Aren't there other and better ways to close the gap? Wouldn't it be more in line with all the analogies in life to believe in some sort of body and world and experience after death that is radically different than this one, as this world is different than life in the womb, rather than just another bigger and better womb? Life doesn't seem to be a series of repetitions, but a series of births, or like multi-stage rockets, the old stage falls away, like the placenta after birth, and the next stage flies into new and higher skies and among new trajectories. Imagine three unborn babies arguing about life after birth. One says it's a myth, the second says it's real and consists of bigger and better wombs, and the third says it's real and almost totally unimaginable. And we all know the third one is right. Well, isn't it reasonable that we're like those babies, and the universe is like a womb, and death is like birth? Obviously, we can't prove that, but signs seem to point that way. You can't go home again. Since birth is the only experience we've ever had that is as radical as death, and seems similar to death in many ways, it seems to be a likely parallel. If so, it's the third baby who's right. Neither the first, the materialist, nor the second, the reincarnationalist. But a third argument for reincarnation is that if a soul is a different kind of thing than a body, as a person is a different kind of thing than a house, then a soul could enter and leave various bodies, like houses, and not just one. If the individual soul is confined to one and only one body and can't reincarnate into others, then it seems the soul isn't really a free and independent spirit, like the guest who is free to change hotels. But is the soul that independent? I think the main reason materialism is credible is all the evidence that the soul is not that independent. If I knock your brains out, I stop you from thinking. We don't think of ourselves as guests in hotels or ghosts in machines. We can't take our bodies off as we can take our clothes off. We are our bodies as well as our souls. The soul would be to the body something like the meaning of a book would be to the words of the book, or the essence of a work of art to the matter it's made out of. We experience our soul and our body not as two things, but as two aspects or dimensions of this one concrete thing we call ourselves. So reincarnation would seem to contradict the basic principle of psychosomatic unity, the oneness of soul and body, which is a good principle of psychology and common sense. A fourth argument for reincarnation is that it does you good to believe it, because it conquers your natural fear of death and your obsession with your body and your body's goods. So it's a sort of Pascal's wager type of argument. It can't be disproved, and it's got a payoff. But the payoff comes in this life rather than the next. You lose nothing, and you gain much by believing it. You gain detachment from the body's goods and evils, especially the greatest bodily evil, death. The problem, though, is that the price it has to pay is a very low view of the body, as an illusion or a temptation or a prison cell or at best a mere temporary container or hotel or moral gymnasium. There are other problems with reincarnation, such as the number of souls. There's been an enormous population explosion in the last few centuries. More people have lived and died in the last two or three centuries than in the previous 30 or 40. Where did all those new souls come from? Another problem is an apparent built-in self-contradiction. Reincarnation is not forever. Once you're sufficiently pure and wise and good, once you're fully cooked, so to speak, you're out of the oven, free from bodies forever, and you can go to heaven. Now, that heaven has to be perfect, otherwise it wouldn't be your goal. But if heaven is perfect, there's no evil in it. So far, so good. But when we trace our series of reincarnations back instead of forward to the first one, we come to this question. Why did I need this whole series of bodies in the first place? If bodies are like reform schools, what sin did I commit to merit being placed in the first reform school? I must have committed some sin in heaven to merit being sent down to earth into my first prison cell, my first body. If my being sent down here was just, then I must have sinned in heaven. And then heaven isn't so perfect after all, so why should I want to go back there? And if it was unjust, if my being sent down here was not deserved, that's even worse, because then there's injustice and sin not just in men, but in the gods. Still another problem with reincarnation is a psychological one. We don't usually remember our past lives, so how can we be said to be the same person as the one who once had another body if there's no continuity of memory? Supposedly, reincarnation is necessary for educational purposes. We need new bodies and new lives to learn the lessons we failed to learn in the last ones. But how can anybody learn from their mistakes if they don't remember their mistakes? Perhaps these questions have decent answers, but I have neither the time nor the expertise to consider them, so I will have to leave the question open. Next time, we will look at different concepts of heaven and see some of the logical difficulties implied in the religious notion of immortality. In this lecture, we examined basically materialism and saw its weaknesses. In the next lecture, we'll redress the balance and look at the notion of immortality and see some of its problems.
This ends Lecture 7. Questions of Faith, Lecture 8. The Case for Life After Death, 12 Arguments.
In our last lecture, we explored some of the materialists' arguments against the existence of life after death. Two lectures from now, we'll explore some of the arguments for the existence of life after death. In this lecture, we'll investigate the nature of life after death by exploring the religious concept of heaven with the critical tools of philosophical reason. And in doing that, we will also continue exploring the case against life after death by examining objections against this religious notion of heaven, and in our next lecture, the notion of hell. At the same time, we will also, by looking at the religious believers' answers to these objections, explore different concepts of the nature of heaven and hell, or what we might find after we die. But first, we probably need to justify spending some time on this topic. The nature of heaven is obviously a very speculative question, and one which most philosophers would say is not appropriate for philosophy at all, because we can have no real knowledge about it. Well, if they mean by real knowledge certain knowledge, I would agree, but probable knowledge, or what Plato called right opinion, ought to count for something at least. And even if we can't find certainty, we could give good reasons for preferring a more probable or likely opinion over a less likely one. So that is a proper question, unless the only proper questions for philosophy are questions that we can get certain answers to. But in that case, you cut away most of philosophy's questions, and almost all of the interesting ones. The more important the question, the less certainty we have about it. And that's a real problem, and there seems to be simply no solution to it. We can't get the most perfect knowledge, certainty, about the most perfect things, things like God and heaven. So we have to choose between less perfect knowledge of more perfect things or more perfect knowledge of less perfect things. Mathematics and physical science give us more perfect knowledge of less perfect things, things less than ourselves, things like planets and numbers. Philosophy, especially philosophy of religion, gives us less perfect knowledge of more perfect things, things above us and beyond us. And those are the most interesting questions and the most important ones, that is, the ones that make the biggest difference to our lives. So if we want to explore those most interesting and important questions, we're just going to have to get over our prejudice that the only knowledge that's worth anything is clear and certain knowledge. I call that a prejudice. It's a very good prejudice in the exact sciences, but I don't think it is in ordinary life. And philosophy, in the sense that Socrates meant it, is the search for wisdom about the great questions of ordinary life, the questions ordinary people ask, not just specialists. I don't think we can argue about the nature of life after death in the same way that we can argue about whether it exists or whether God exists. That is, we can't focus on one single question, which has only two possible answers, yes or no, and then find 10 or 20 clear arguments for each side and put them in logical form of syllogisms and then see whether there are logical weaknesses in each argument. Yet the question of heaven and hell is obviously an important question, and an interesting one. In fact, I challenge you to even imagine a more interesting one. And it's not just subjectively interesting, but also objectively and truly important because it makes such a big difference for so many people. Most people do believe in some kind of heaven and hope that they will go there forever after they die. So this is a reasonable question for the philosophy of religion to think about. Here are 10 objections to heaven, that is, to the idea of heaven that's taught by the Orthodox versions of the three major Western religions. They are, in 10 words, that heaven is unscientific, anthropomorphic, logically meaningless, wishful thinking, escapist, selfish, inhuman, unjust, unfree, and boring. The first objection is that the idea of heaven is unscientific superstition. But if that's the objection, the believer's reply could easily be that that objection is unscientific. The scientific way to refute an idea is by evidence, not labels and name-calling. Well, then the objector could say, here is some evidence. Statistically, belief in heaven is directly proportionate to lack of scientific education. Historically, belief in heaven has been regressing in direct proportion to science progressing in the last 4 or 5 centuries. The believer could reply that to argue that an idea is false because those who believe it are uneducated is the logical fallacy called ad hominem, attacking the person instead of the idea. That does not disprove the idea. You need argument. Well, then, the objector could say, here is some evidence. Statistically, belief in heaven is directly proportionate to lack of scientific education. The believer could reply that to argue that an idea is false because those who believe it are uneducated is the logical fallacy called ad hominem, attacking the person instead of the idea. That does not disprove the idea. You need an argument. Well, here is an argument. Historically, belief in heaven has been regressing in direct proportion to science progressing. Fewer and fewer people believe it today. But this is still a fallacy and not an argument. This one is called ad populum, trying to find truth by counting noses. What is the logical argument that shows that science has refuted the idea of heaven? The objector could say that the logical argument is this: the idea cannot, in principle, be verified or falsified by any of the sciences. This is true, but it doesn't seem to prove that the idea is therefore false. Let's back up and make some basic logical distinctions here. I think you have to distinguish 5 questions about any idea whatsoever. First, is it true? Second, if it is true, can we know it? Something may be true but unknown. Third, if we can know it, can we give reasons for it? Can we prove it? Not all that we know, we can prove. Fourth, if we can give reasons for it, do these reasons make it certain? Can we prove it with certainty, or only with probability? Not all arguments claim certainty. Many good reasons are only probable. And finally, the 5th question, if we can prove it with certainty, is that proof a scientific proof? There may be other methods of proof. For instance, philosophy uses proofs, but not by the scientific method. A more concrete and specific objection, then, would be that the idea of heaven with its golden streets and jeweled gates and thrones and crystal seas and angels and robes and harps and halos, or the Quranic version of paradise with palaces, oases, and a harem of virgins, certainly looks man-made, mythical, and anthropomorphic, a projection of earthly things valued by past cultures. The intelligent believer will probably reply that all those details are symbolic, not literal. Taking them literally does indeed result in scientific and logical absurdities, but that's like mistaking the man in the moon for a biological man, or expecting a catty woman to have kittens. But then the objector can argue that if all the language about heaven is symbolic, we should be able to say what it symbolizes, as we can with the man in the moon or a catty woman. But we can't. We can't translate the symbolic language into non-symbolic language, except maybe vague platitudes like goodness and happiness. So it seems that we simply don't know anything at all about heaven, and that it's foolish and arrogant to think we do. The believer is mistaking symbols for knowledge. The reply might be that symbolic knowledge can be knowledge, even though it's not literal, and even if it's not translatable into something literal. That would seem to be the difference between symbolism and allegory. An allegory is a symbol that is translatable into something literal, like a code. But symbols give us a different kind of knowledge, by analogies or likeness. Knowing that God is more like a good father than like a bad father or like a tyrant would seem to be meaningful, even though God is not literally either because he's not a human being. So to say that heaven is more like a castle than like a doghouse, or more like gold than like mud, is only an analogy, but it can be a meaningful analogy. Analogies and symbols, even if they can't be translated into literal, non-symbolic language, can still point in the right direction, towards the truth rather than away from it. A third objection is a psychological one. The idea of heaven is so easily explainable by wishful thinking. Voltaire said, if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. The same could be said about heaven. It's a necessary dream. The match between our wishes and the idea of heaven is too perfect not to suspect that the idea is a projection of our wishes. The believer might reply that there is indeed a match, but it could be explained the other way around, by our desires being designed to fit the real heaven. Is the hand made to fit the glove, or the glove the hand? Is the key made for the lock, or the lock for the key? Is God made in our image, or are we made in his? Both hypotheses explain the facts. And if the argument is that if there were no heaven, we would have to believe in one, in fact, exactly the one we do believe in, therefore there is no heaven, if that's the argument, that's also logically fallacious. Technically, that's affirming the consequent. It's like arguing that if there were no meaning at all, we would have to invent one, therefore there is no meaning at all. Or if 2 and 2 did not equal 4, we would still believe it did, therefore it doesn't. The believer might also claim that heaven doesn't correspond to our wishful thinking, because our wishful thinking is egotistic, but heaven isn't. It's the place for self-forgetful saints, not self-indulgent dreamers, the death of egotism rather than its gratification. A fourth argument is that the idea of heaven seems escapist, something like treason to our home, this world. It devalues this world by comparing it unfavorably with the next. How could you seriously take the things of this world if you believe that there's a next world that's infinitely better? There's a very simple answer to that. If the idea is true, it would be escapist not to think about it. Is it escapist for a baby in the womb to think about life in the world after birth? Yes, but only if it's not true, if that world is not there. So it is indeed escapist to think about heaven if it's not there. But that's what the argument is supposed to prove. So the argument begs the question. It assumes what it's supposed to prove. And even if the idea were escapist, that wouldn't prove it's not true. The idea that there is a tunnel under the prison is an escapist idea, but it may be true. The only honest reason for disbelieving any idea is that it's not true. And the only honest reason for believing any idea is that it is true. But if we don't know whether an idea is true or false, isn't it honest to evaluate it by looking at its effects in the lives of those who believe it? That's data too, and it's not honest to ignore any data. So what about the bad effects of the belief in heaven, this devaluation of this world? The believer would have to make the case that the idea does not devalue this world, because if it did, that would certainly be a very heavy count against it. And he can point to the fact that throughout history, it has often been those who believed most strongly in heaven who have made some of the greatest improvements to this world. The picture of the wild-eyed religious fanatic, obsessed and pessimistic, preaching gloom and doom and predestination and curses and waiting for the world to end, that's not the ordinary religious believer. That's the Red Sox fan. Seriously, it seems reasonable that belief in heaven should not devalue this world, but make it more valuable. Any road gets its value from its destination. The roads that led to gold mines in California were cared for and paved over and made into superhighways, while the roads that led to ghost towns were not. So neither the objector nor the believer can prove that heaven does or does not exist by psychological arguments like these. They're more suspicions than arguments, and suspicions simply cancel each other out. But a fifth objection is a more serious one. It's a moral one, that heaven is a bribe. It appeals to selfishness. It motivates us to be good, not for goodness' sake, but for the sake of those nice heavenly rewards that we'll get. It says, be a giver in this world so you can be a taker in the next. Well, that's mercenary. I think this is a serious objection, and it probably describes many believers' motives with embarrassing accuracy. But, of course, impugning the motive for believing an idea doesn't prove the idea is false. But it does show not just a psychologically bad effect of believing it, but a morally bad effect. So the believer would have to make out the case that the motive for believing in heaven doesn't have to be mercenary and isn't supposed to be. But heaven is a reward. And isn't working for a reward necessarily mercenary? Well, not necessarily. Romeo would be a mercenary lover if he courted Juliet for her money, but he's not a mercenary lover for him to court Juliet for herself. I'd be a mercenary teacher if I taught mainly for money. I'd also be stupid. The money's not that good. But I'm not mercenary if I teach for the reward of seeing students' minds light up. Some rewards are proper and natural. The popular version of heaven certainly seems mercenary. But those jeweled gates and golden cities, these can be interpreted not as a reward for honesty and justice and mercy and love, but as symbolizing those very things themselves perfected, as the non-mercenary, unselfish, unselfconscious love of God and neighbor. The saints and mystics say heaven is ecstasy, but what ecstasy literally means is almost the same as unselfishness. Ecstasis means standing outside yourself, identifying so much with the other, being so in love with the other that you forget yourself. And perhaps there is some heavenly wisdom even if there is no heaven, because that's the secret of joy in any possible world, heaven or earth. At this point, the objector may protest that we're going now to the other extreme. Now heaven sounds too unselfish to turn anybody on except a saint. And the believer could answer that that's what we're all destined to be in heaven, saints. And if you protest that you won't like heaven because it's too unselfish, that only proves that you haven't tried it, that you haven't really tried honestly unselfish love, because if you try it, you'll like it. In other words, the claim is that this idea can be verified or falsified in this world by experiment in the laboratory that is your life, whether or not there is a next world. A sixth argument is that heaven is for angels, not humans. It's too spiritual. What makes us happy is sex and beer and rock and roll, or art and wine and symphonies. Or kids. No more kids in heaven. That certainly sounds like heaven isn't fit for human habitation, but only for angels. Let's focus the objection on one thing and ask this question. Is there sex in heaven or not? Let's ask it in the form of a dilemma. If there is, heaven seems ridiculously earthly. If there isn't, Americans won't want to go there. The believer could answer simply that the objector's imagination is too limited. How do you know what will turn you on in the next life? Why set limits to your spiritual growth? A more positive answer might be the idea of transformation. We can ask thousands of questions in the form, will there be X in heaven or not? And the answer to most of them probably has to be neither a simple yes nor a simple no, but yes in a transformed form. For instance, take emotions. Will we have emotions in heaven or not? Emotions are part of human nature, so if human nature is perfected in heaven, it would logically follow that we will have emotions there. But emotions can blind us and control us. So in heaven, they would have to be transformed into things freely chosen, as we now freely choose to move our limbs. We can conceive a state in which emotions are there, and powerful and even passionate, but they don't drive us. We drive them, like sports cars. Emotions would be less passive, but not less passionate. Now, that conception, whether it's literally true or not, whether it's an accurate picture of the next world or not, is certainly relevant to this world. It's a way of avoiding both extremes of puritanical, stoical suppression of emotions and addictive slavery to them, without settling for a compromise of half suppression and half addiction. So again, whether heaven is real or not, it could be a relevant and useful model for earth. But what about the question about sex? Well, if heaven perfects and transforms our human nature, and if sex is an important part of our human nature, part of our identity, not just something we do, but something we are, then it logically follows that heaven would perfect and transform sex too. But how? Obviously, we don't know. But we may have analogies, not for the knowledge that we don't have, but for our ignorance. Heaven might perfect earthly sex in ways that we can no more understand now than an unborn baby can understand the pleasures of sex outside the womb. Will we have sex in heaven is probably like the question of the 5-year-old boy whose father is trying to explain the pleasures of sexual intercourse, and the boy asks, "Can I play with my model airplanes while I do it?" If the questions are similar, the answers probably are too. You didn't think a course in the philosophy of religion would talk about sex in heaven, did you? Much less that it would try to be logical about it. You see, philosophy can be more interesting than you think. Obviously, these opinions are speculation, but they can be reasoned speculation. And much of philosophy is like that, somewhere between mathematically certain proofs and sheer arbitrary feelings. A seventh argument against heaven is that it would be boring. This is not as shallow an objection as it sounds. Boredom is a very serious problem. Children usually behave themselves if they're not bored and misbehave if they are. And if you ask what that has to do with grown-ups, I'll answer, grown-ups, who are they? I've never met one, have you? There are three parts to this objection. Heaven is boring because there's no time there, no contrast between good and evil, and no work. Heaven is supposed to be eternal. Well, eternity sounds much more boring than time. And all pleasure and no pain sounds boring too. We appreciate things only by contrast. And what in the world will we do in heaven? Much of the pleasure in this life is meaningful work, but you can't imagine most earthly works being continued into heaven. Before looking at possible answers to these questions, I want to explain once again why it's worthwhile taking our time to do that. These are unusual questions. It's to see how strong each side can be in the debate between the believer and the unbeliever, of course, about whether this is a credible notion. But it's not mainly to explore the nature of life in heaven. It's mainly to look for some wisdom for life on earth. Putting many of these topics into the context of heaven can shed new light on those topics right here. For instance, time. Suppose you said eternity includes all time rather than excluding it. Somewhat as a three-dimensional solid includes two-dimensional shapes. That would explain a fairly common phenomenon in this life that when you're about to die, your whole life often passes before you in an instant, in perfect order and clarity. Or those timeless moments or peak experiences during your lifetime when you lose all sense of time. They don't seem timeless because they're thinner than time. They seem thicker than time, so to speak. There's more in them, not less. As for the second part of the question, how we could appreciate pleasure without contrast to pain, I think experience in this world answers that question fairly well. The wiser you are, the less you need that contrast. The wiser you are, the less bored you are with goodness and truth and beauty, and the less you need evil and falsehood and ugliness to appreciate them. It would follow that if there is a God who is totally wise, he would never be bored. And that the more godlike you get, the less bored you'd be, the less you need any kind of evil to appreciate good. And that is what heaven is for, according to the religious idea, to become more like God. The idea of heaven is relative to the idea of God, not vice versa. So the religious idea is consistent, even though it's not provable, and it's relevant, even if it's not true. What about the third question? What work could we possibly do in heaven, and why wouldn't it bore us? The question could be put in the form of a dilemma. Either it's earthly work or unearthly work. If it's earthly work, that presupposes some need. For instance, police work means that people need protection, and medical work means that people need medical care, and that means heaven would not be perfect. But if it's unearthly work, like perpetual adoration of God, well, that seems fit for angels, but not for human beings. And an endless church service seems more like hell than like heaven. So the dilemma is it imperfect and interesting, or is it perfect and boring? Well, the only good answer I've come across in this regard is from Richard Pertill's book, Thinking About Religion. He suggests we'll do in heaven the six things that never get boring on earth, the six things we never do adequately on earth, the six things that are the reason why we exist on earth in the first place, the meaning of our lives. They are understanding yourself, loving yourself, understanding others, understanding God, and loving God. Understanding and loving, the acts of the rational intellect and the free will, are the two things that seem to distinguish us from all other animals, the two unique powers of the human soul. And they go together. You can't really understand anyone unless you love them, and you can't really love them unless you understand them. And the three objects of self, others, and God are the three things we can do this to. They're also the only three objects that don't get boring, that you don't come to an end of. So that would make the picture consistent. It would fit. How might we do these six things in heaven? Well, how do we do them here? In many different ways. How would we do them there? Probably in ways that will make earthly romance, marriage, family, charities, politics, art, science, philosophy, theology, poetry, and music look like watermelon seeds compared to a watermelon. An eighth objection to heaven is that it would stifle individuality. If we're all perfect in heaven, we'd all be conformist clones of God. But would we have to be clones of God? Good parents don't want their children to be clones of them. And even if we were clones of God, that could be the secret of individuality rather than the death of it. Clones or copies of each other would, of course, be dull and stifle individuality, but if God were like a diamond with infinitely different facets, then each of his human clones, so to speak, could reflect an absolutely unique facet. If God invented human individuality, then getting closer to God wouldn't lessen individuality, but would increase it. Somewhat as light could increase the individuality of every color, or salt could increase the individuality of each flavor, making fish fishier and eggs eggier and steak steakier. And there even seems to be some empirical evidence on earth for this answer, because even now, the saints are the real individuals. They're all characters. No one who knows them could ever confuse Doubting Thomas, Thomas Aquinas, Thomas a Kempis, and Thomas a Becket, or Teresa of Avila and Teresa of Lisieux and Mother Teresa. It's the great sinners who are so drearily alike. Hitler is just Stalin with a smaller beard and a bigger mouth. A problem closely connected with individuality is freedom. Let's put the question about freedom in the form of a logical dilemma. Would we be free to sin in heaven or not? If so, heaven is a dangerous place, like earth. Once the first person chooses to sin, it's the apple and the snake all over again. But if not, if there's no freedom to sin in heaven, then it's tyranny, and we're robots or puppets, and God doesn't get our free love, but only our forced love, which is cheap and tyrannical and even impossible. Forced love is an oxymoron. That's another good objection, which demands a good reply. That's how philosophical dialogue and debate works, of course. Whichever side is right, each side draws out the best objections and replies in the other. That's why I think dialogue is the best way to do philosophy. Socrates was right. Well, as for freedom to sin in heaven, the believer could say there's a logical contradiction inherent in that term. Freedom to sin is like free slavery or free addiction. That's what St. Augustine says. He distinguishes two meanings of freedom, free will or free choice, and liberty. Free choice is the opposite of compulsion from without. Liberty is the opposite of compulsion from within, a kind of inner slavery. Free choice is freedom from, liberty is freedom to. That is, free choice is freedom from causal determinism. Liberty is freedom to become your true self, freedom from any obstacle to becoming who you really are, like addictions, whether to physical things like drugs or non-physical things like pride. Augustine says we all have free will, the lower freedom, but we don't all have liberty, the higher freedom. And we can use our free will to choose liberty or to choose slavery. For instance, we can choose justice or injustice, love or hate, honesty or dishonesty. And that difference, for him, is not just the difference between obeying or disobeying a set of rules, but between attaining or failing to attain our identity, our full humanity, and therefore our full joy. The evil choice is a kind of slavery, a kind of addiction, like Gollum in The Lord of the Rings, or Gyges in Plato's Republic. That's the same ring, by the way, and the same theme. Augustine says, "We forge the chains of our bondage with the strength of our freedom." But we could also forge the sword of our liberty with the strength of our freedom and cut those bonds. So in heaven, we could have free will, because not to have free will is not to be human. But if we're going to be perfect in heaven, we would also want to have such perfect liberty that no one will do evil because no one will want to. Well, why would no one want to? Probably because everyone would see how ugly and joyless evil is. They'd see that very clearly, and how joyful and beautiful the good is. We don't see that clearly now. That's why we do evil. It looks like fun. Plato believed that all evil doing came from ignorance. That seems to make sense because we always choose what appears good, what looks attractive, what looks happifying to us. We always seek happiness, and we don't seek the good only because we don't identify the good with our happiness. Evil has to appear as somehow good for something, or we wouldn't choose it. Well, what is it that fails to distinguish the apparent good from the real good? Ignorance. Therefore, all evil comes from ignorance. The argument seems to be accurate. But if we're honest with ourselves, I think we have to admit that our ignorance, in turn, often comes from ignoring, from not looking at the truth. So it's an ignorance we're responsible for. For instance, when we listen to the voice of temptation that tells us how happy we'd be if we got away with embezzling a few million dollars and padding our pitiful bank account, and when we ignore the other voice, the voice of conscience, that tells us we'd be happier deep down and in the long run if we had a good, honest soul rather than a good bank account, our ignorance then is something we create in ourselves, something we're responsible for. So I think Plato is right that all evil does come from ignorance, but he forgets that also ignorance comes from evil, from the will to ignore the truth. Well, how does that help us to sort out our question about heaven? Well, in heaven, there would not be any ignorance. If we would all be in the presence of God, the beatific vision, that would dispel ignorance as the sun dispels fog. And that's why we would never choose evil in heaven, even though we had free will. That seems like a consistent answer. Of course, it doesn't prove anything. It assumes God and heaven and free will and good and evil, but it is consistent. A ninth objection is almost exactly the opposite of the one before. The one before worried we'd all be the same in heaven. This objection worries that we won't. It objects to the traditional notion that heaven is hierarchical rather than egalitarian, that we will not all be equal in heaven. Doesn't that make God a snob, an elitist, and an aristocrat? Well, I think some of the other objections were very strong, but I think this one is rather weak, even though it's quite common. It basically amounts to accusing God of not being an American. The British answer to that would probably be simply, quite. But seriously, even though we want to reject inequality and hierarchy in politics, to judge heaven by our political categories seems a bit like judging Einstein by how well he matched his socks. And are inequality and hierarchy such bad things in themselves? They certainly describe the way nature works. And if God created nature, it would seem to follow that God likes these things. He invented them. Now, my point is not that proves you ought to like it, but simply that the believer's picture still holds together as logically consistent. And it also seems to follow from the essential nature of justice. Justice implies hierarchy. Justice doesn't mean simply equality. It means equal treatment of equals, but it also means unequal treatment of unequals. It's not justice to treat those who deserve an A and those who deserve an F by giving them both the same grade. Here's another deeper reason for hierarchy in heaven. One of the greatest joys in this life is finding someone you can admire and look up to. Why should heaven deprive us of that joy? And if you don't like that, if you want to say to everybody else, "I'm just as good as you are," If you say that, I think you don't really believe what you say. Because you wouldn't have to say that if you believed it. The only reason you say it is because you don't. A tenth and final objection to heaven is that there would be no privacy there. Certainly there would be no privacy from God if God knows everything. And if, as we supposed a little while ago, everyone in heaven knows and understands each other perfectly, there would be no privacy from other people either. And that would be intolerable. That would be Sartre's hell. Hell is other people. This fear may be real, but the objection seems fairly easy to answer. The only reason we want privacy now, the only reason we want to hide from other people, is because we feel shame, and because we fear other people will misunderstand us and look down on us or reject us or despise us. But in heaven, there would be no shame if all evil is gone, and there would be no fear that anyone would misunderstand you or reject you. And perhaps those are our deepest fears. Well, what have we accomplished in this very speculative lecture? Four things, I think. We've looked at the unbeliever's objections to heaven and hopefully understood them. We've looked at the believer's answers to these objections and hopefully understood them. We've assessed the logical force of the answers over against the force of the objections and come to the conclusion that the objector has not proved his case, although the believer has not proved his case either, but just maintained logical consistency. Heaven may still be a dream, but at least it's a consistent dream. And finally, we've looked at the religious picture of heaven and tried to find some earthly analogies which might give us some double illumination. Not only did the earthly analogies help us to understand the concept of heaven, but the concepts of heaven, whether real or not, sometimes cast new light on our present lives. The hardest part of the theistic belief in life after death to defend is not heaven, but hell. We'll look at that difficulty in our next lecture, for that will complete the case against life after death, and then we'll look at the case for it.
This ends Lecture 8.